Dublin, and this is our first report.
We arrived at the airport. We came into our hotel. We're staying at the Shelburne, and now we're out looking at people.
Yes, and we're right straight across the street from the Lord Mayor's mansion, which was in the process of being renovated last time we were here. It's all beautifully painted and well done at the moment.
As we came by, we saw a sign that said, Irish Lifeboats Sail. Now, are they selling lifeboats? We were curious, so we paid our one shilling admission and went inside. And you know what we ran into in the middle of downtown Dublin? A rummage sale.
Yeah, really, truly. With a lovely tea area set up right in the middle of a very large room and the little rummage table set up neatly all the way around. All well divided into their proper categories. And evidently, this is a sale to buy lifeboats. But I'm not sure for what.
There's going to be an auction in about 15 or 20 minutes, but we don't have time to wait. It'd be a ball to catch the sound of an auction, but maybe we should go back. We are standing in front of a real estate office now. Now, for Essex and Costello and Ted Buck and all of our buddies all around Crystal Lake, let us read to you the information on a couple of houses that are for sale over here just outside of Dublin. Here's one called Holly Mount. For auction, valuable stud farm. Charming Georgian house approached by a drive through parkland. Well-proportioned rooms and beautiful views over the surrounding 160 acres. This property is a registered stud and has excellent outbuildings, hay barns, stables, paddocks, and so forth. Staff accommodation and wall garden. Four reception rooms, modern kitchen, six bedrooms, two bathrooms, and staff quarters. Now, how could you turn that down?
Well, here's one we could afford better. This is Manane Bridge in County Cork, a small farmhouse standing on 1 acre. And then in parentheses, it says, in need of renovation. Cork City, 15 miles. It has three reception rooms, four bedrooms, a bathroom, a kitchen, and it's a freehold.
The way we go window shopping all the time, wherever we go, we also go real estate admiring. So this was one of the first things we happened to see. Now, as for weather and a few of the specifics, it was 4 below zero in Montreal. We made a stop last night and I guess took on fuel and took on some more passengers. Then we came out over the Atlantic and it was dark, dark, dark. And when we woke up this morning, it was light, light, light. As we came in across Ireland, we could see little flecks of snow. We stopped at Shannon. It was middle 30s, not too cold at all. And would you believe, in Ireland, even in February, there is a very definite green cast to all the grass and all the trees. We came into Dublin. It's a beautiful, sunshiny day. I'd say it's mid-40s now. They had a bit of snow this morning. You can still see some lingering in secluded, sheltered spots. But really, it's a very nice day. And we came to the hotel, and Joe and Pat immediately dragged me out shopping. My biological clock is a wreck, but we're going out to dinner tonight. We're going to catch some Irish folk ballads, so we'll be reporting to you then. Any observations you'd like to make on Dublin at the moment?
Just that you've been standing talking so long that all the shops have closed now. That's how he gets out of shopping, see? Talking to all of you.
Save the buck at that. Don't worry. In this next week, there'll be considerable shopping done. Anyway, that's our first report from Dublin. It's here. It's much as we remember it, and it's beautiful. And I bet you've heard some of the sounds of rush hour behind us. Yes, there's even a bit of pollution over here. Hate to admit it, but it's true.
so black eyes already, and cheetah from his gum. Then Paul became a member of this terrible football club. I was born ready, he was born a man. Everybody just take it away, the reason that he had a feast was taken out of the service. So watch his golden drum, since Paul became a member of the terrible football club. The first game that he played, that they the service ever saw. Two for blood, for gold, for sand, and his hand for a ball. The Lord Mayor, he was there, and the Lord and Lady Grand. And Paul got the snoring box and made a hogan stand. But he put Paul crazy, he put Paul mad. Head from Charlie to take it away to the success he had. It was taken under service. So what you saw in trouble, this Paul became a member of this terrible club. In the middle of the table now, so the captain said to Paul, would you like to take the place? He said, you're mad about football. He said, 40 paces backwards, shut off from the bar. And his father's dead and all the bad and laughing in New York. But he was born pretty, he was born a man. And the football just take away the reason that he had. It was taken out of service. So I just saw the trouble. Then Paul became a member of the terrible football club. And another. His way says that he lives, it's called the league. Away from football, kicking at nighttime in his sleep. He cried out at the penalty, and other things so droll. Last night he shot her out of bed and swore it was a goal. But he was all crazy, he was all mad. And the football is taken away, the lesson that he had. It was taken up to service. So I just saw his trouble, this Paul became a member of his terrible football club.
Do it. I told you one of the things that we were coming to Ireland to do was to find some real honest-to-goodness Irish singing, and you just heard it. And this is in a room called The Loft, and we're just outside of Dublin. In fact, we are at the Abbey Tavern in Howth, H-O-W-T-H. And John Kennedy, yes, really, John Kennedy is our friend from Irish Tourist, and he's with us, and he's going to be going around with us this week to show us some of the things in Ireland that we have wanted to see. And we've just come from downstairs. This is a totally delightful restaurant because the emphasis is seafood, and there's a reason why. This restaurant is located right on a point of land at, is it Dublin Bay, John? Is that what you call it?
Yes, you would call it Dublin Bay. It's part of the peninsula running out on the north fork of Dublin Bay.
And as we drove down here tonight, we could see the fishing trawlers that had pulled back in for the weekend. And so I guess it's a pretty easy matter to get the fish from the trawlers over here to this particular restaurant.
Oh, yeah, this is why it specializes in fish food.
All right, Joe, now it's your turn. You can talk a little bit about the food, which is one of our main specialties.
Oh, well, it is really delicious. We started out, well, let's see, Pat is with us, and you had scallops.
Au gratin.
And let her say it herself, yeah. And?
Yes. And poached salmon, which is delicious.
And we had, I had scotch froth, and you had chowder, of course.
The Howth chowder, H-O-W-T-H, Howth chowder, great.
And then I had sole, because I have been told repeatedly in the United States that we never see sole in the United States, that what we are served as sole is flounder. And after tonight, I have to tend to agree. I don't think I've ever tasted a fish quite like that I had. This is a very special sole abbey stuffed with shrimp and herbs and served in a sauce, but beautifully cooked because it was not overcooked. And you had prawn marnay.
Marnay, very good. A little tiny fellows, but done with a special sauce with rice and just delicious. Very good.
It really was. And it's sort of unusual to find a taverny sort of spot where the emphasis is on song and music to find the food so good. You wouldn't really expect it. I wouldn't.
We came in, and first you come right into a room that is a bar, and you get this wonderful aroma as you walk in the door. This is a fireplace, and you really need it, because this is the central heating. It's the fireplace.
And we're in the chilly time of year.
Yes, we are. There's snow on the ground outside, so everybody comes in with a little, gee, it's good to get in out of the cold feeling. This is a real peat fireplace, and somehow peat gives out an aroma that is so pleasant. It's almost like birchwood. It has a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good smell.
To it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the lights are gas lights, and the beams are real beams. And
the lights in the bar were gas, and these up here seem to be gas. The lighting in the dining room were actual kerosene lamps on the wall.
John, could you give us just a little of the background of this place? They know you here, so I must assume that you've been here a few times before. Yes.
Well, the pub is built on a site that was originally an abbey. That is why, in fact, it's called the Abbey Tavern. The abbey goes back to the 15th century, and some of the walls in here are, in fact, part of the old walls of the abbey. If you step outside the Abbey Tavern itself, you will see part of the structure of the ruins of the abbey even to this day. It started as just a small pub in a fishing village. And Mrs. Scott Lennon, who owns the establishment, decided to introduce ballads, the old form of ballads. And she got a small group together about 10 years ago, and they sang and played various musical instruments, mainly traditional instruments, of course, including the Illion pipes, to mainly Dubliners. Dubliners use this a great deal. This is not just a tourist haunt. It's a place for Dubliners to come. And it has grown up in that time to become rather a famous landmark for entertainment in Dublin. Now, you spoke earlier about being on the loft.
Yes.
Well, the whole place is really a barn and a loft. And we use the loft in winter time. It's a smaller room, the long room, and one that would typify carrying of hay.
Sure.
The barn itself, as you probably saw downstairs, is, as one would expect, a large open barn. And in summertime, the barn is used for the ballad singing. And in wintertime, the loft is used where we are now.
Is this the same group here that's mostly throughout the whole year?
The same group. It's a group of about 12 singers and performers, and they play alternately six each consecutive night. So you have a continuous performance, except on Sunday. It's 6 days of the week, except on Sundays.
Well, it's very good to see that the Irish themselves like the music that we in America think of as being Irish music. Pat, do you think you found something to replace the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem?
Oh, this will do it. This is fabulous.
What was the comment you made about spoons?
That I never knew that two spoons could be so absolutely marvelous.
That was the clicking sound you heard in the background. So this is stop number one of major consequence on this trip to Ireland, and I would hope when any of the rest of you get across to Dublin that you'll not just be content to live around St. Stephen's Square, that you will make the trip down here to Howth and by all means come to the Abbey Tavern, because this has got all the personality, this has got the feeling of the Ireland that I think of when I think of this beautiful green land. Okay, that's for it for now.
Wakeford, God for his greatness, how men could fight.
a stubborn weary and barbarous old man.
These are the Irish pipes. Thank you.
here before, is that right?
Joe and I told you that one of the main reasons we were coming to Ireland this time was the last time we were here, we were right between phases of the world-famous Abbey Theater. And just as the bridge over the Liffey River is famous and the Shamrock is famous, certainly the Abbey Theater, to those who appreciate theater, is just one of those things. So this morning, we have come to the Abbey Theater to meet Mr. Gabriel Fallon, who is an actor, one of the directors of the famous theater, and can take us back in history. We're also talking to Mr. Kelly, who is the manager of the theater. So let's just sort of squeeze in here and get acquainted. And Mr. Fallon was just telling us about the relationship that Chicago has to the Abbey Theater. Since many Chicagoans are hearing this right now, would you say it again?
Yes, way back in 1911, there was a little theater in Chicago run by an English poet, Morris Brown, and his girlfriend, Ellen Van Valkenburg. And during that year, the Abbey happened to go, it was on an American tour, happened to go to Chicago. And Brown and Miss Van Valkenburg went to see the Abbey players, and of course were astonished and amazed and very pleased. And then they had an interview with Lady Gregory. And they brought Lady Gregory down to the little theater, and they told her what they were doing. And she gave them a great deal of encouragement. And they said, well, of course, we're very poor. And she said, so we were, and so on. And she gave them the blessing. And they went right ahead, and the Chicago Little Theater became a very famous little theater. And indeed, to my knowledge, it was the first of the little theaters in America. So that, in a sense, Lady Gregory might be called the godmother of the little theaters in America. And then you've got to remember that, of course, that visit of the Abbey had a terrific influence on Eugene O'Neill. And Eugene O'Neill, who is a member, or was a member of the Irish Academy of Letters, was very anxious to have his plays produced at the Abbey Theatre. And of course, we are unique in this sense that we gave, without cutting a single word or comma, his greatest play, Long Day's Journey Into Night. We did that when we were outhoused at the Queen's Theatre, and we shall hope to do it again here in our new theatre.
Now, I think probably for those Americans who have not seen the new theatre, Joe, why don't you move your chair over here a little bit, too, so this becomes a kind of a round robin. Mr. Fallon, would you bring us now, initially, from the beginning of the new theatre up to the time, and then we'll drop back in like a few months.
Yes, well, of course, since we came in here, we have two theatres here. We have the Abbey Theatre proper, and then we have this magnificent little experimental theatre called the Peacock Theatre, which is right below the Abbey, the building we're in at the moment. Now, since we came here, we have been, to my mind, amazingly active, because we've had plays in the main theatre, we've had plays in the little theatre, the little Peacock Theatre, and we've gone on fairly extensive tours at the same time. We went to Florence a few years ago, and we were the old showpiece of the Florence Festival. We went to Paris last year. We also conduct, and this is rather interesting, a tour of the Gaeltacht, the Irish-speaking districts of Ireland, where we present plays through the medium of the Irish language. Indeed, it should be noted that all our players, are the 35 members of our company, are bilingual. That is to say, they can act in their own native tongue and they can act in English at the same time. Now, we've had a number of great successes since we opened here in the new theatre. I suppose the most outstanding amongst them is Bartle Boy, which very shortly will be seen on Broadway. Now, we would love to bring our entire company to Broadway. Instead of that, we can only send our director, Tomás McConaughey, and we can only send our two leading actors, because equity rules will not allow us to bring in any more. Now, that should open very shortly on Broadway, and I would be very surprised if it was not a great success. Even as big a success as Friedel's play, Philadelphia, Here I Come.
Joe?
Well, I'd like to know, really, how old is the Abbey Theatre? When did it begin?
Well, the Abbey Theatre opened its doors on the 26th of December, 1904. The original building did. That was the building that was given to Yeats and Lady Gregory by this very generous Englishwoman, Anna Frederica Horniman, the daughter of a very wealthy Manchester family that had made its money out of tea. Now, the Abbey Theatre has been running unbrokenly since, and that despite a war of independence and a civil war, which affected the Abbey to a certain extent. For instance, in 1916, two members of the Abbey Company, three members of the Abbey, indeed I could say four or five, if I include the stage staff, went out and took part in the Easter Rising. The Abbey was closed that week, because the fighting, of course, was in O'Connell Street and all around here.
I'm just kind of following up through time. We were sitting here in this room, and I was looking around and seeing many of the posters of the plays that you have done. Mr. Kelly, would you come into this little group here, too, please, and describe some of these posters and some of the shows?
Well, in this room, which we're sitting at the moment, this is what we call the presidential room, because this is the room where the President of Ireland comes when he's attending the Abbey.
We're in the President's room. Right. I'm very impressed.
Well, now, these are the originals of the posters which we've issued since we've come to the new Abbey, which, as you know, was 4 years ago, coming next July. And these posters arose from a conversation I had with three of our leading painters, George Campbell, Arthur Armstrong, and Jerry Dillon. And they felt that the artist, as against the artists, the artists of Ireland should contribute something to the National Theatre. They said that we made every endeavour to put an artistic piece on the stage, but then put bloody awful posters outside to advertise it. And so I asked them what they would do, and they said they would contribute the posters free. Now, these are the originals, and the first one of all was Arthur Armstrong's poster for Long Day's Journey Into Night. I heard Mr. Fallon telling you that about the Abbey's association with Eugene O'Neill and how the Abbey had put on his play in the Abbey, but he didn't tell you that we brought that very same play to the smalls of Ireland, villages of 20 persons, and put on that long play, and they enjoyed it immensely. But so the other artists followed suit, and well, as a quid pro quo, we now sell these posters to especially to our friends who come to us from America, and the royalty then goes to the artists. In other words, we are renewing the, or giving back to their generosity. Some of them are significant. That one over there is by Dr. Michael McLeamore. In America, you may know him as an actor through his importance of being Oscar, but he is also, as you can see,
very good artist.
He is indeed, yes. Red Roses for Me, this is what we put on here 2 years ago. That's Sean O'Casey's. That's by Jerry Dillon. You can see the clown influence which Jerry has in most of his paintings. The next one here is the Chacron. The Chacron, we brought this to... this is very funny, this one, the Chacron. As you know, the Abbey was allegedly set up to kill melodrama. And the first thing the Abbey does when it gets into a new building, it puts on a big performance, a big production of the Chacron. And not alone that, but brings it to the World Theatre season in London. But although it's said that the Abbey was there to kill melodrama, I think Boucicault is one that stands out, and I'm sure Mr. Fallon could tell you how O'Casey was, and Brendan Behan, were influenced so much by Boucicault.
Let's just halt right there for just a moment.
Look, Boucicault is very well known in the United States.
Yes.
In fact, of course, he was the author of a considerable number of melodramas, 40 or 50 or something, and they were all perhaps better known in the United States than here. But his Irish ones, like Aaron and Pogue and Chacron, were very well known here, and very well known in London. Indeed, Queen Victoria is reputed to have gone to Aaron and Pogue, or the Colleen Bawn, rather, 11 times. And he did have an influence not only on Sean O'Casey, but also on John Millington Synge, who was one of the first directors of the Abbey Theatre, along with Lady Gregory and Yeats. Of course, you have a thing about posters in America. Mm-hmm. And as Mr. Kelly told you, we've had reprints of these posters done. And a great deal of them have gone to the United States. But now we have destroyed the plates, and therefore the posters are becoming more valuable day after day.
Let's spend a moment on Sean O'Casey now. I suppose you have some memories.
Some memories? Well, as a matter of fact, I've written a book about Sean O'Casey.
Have you really?
Yes. Sean O'Casey, the man I knew, which is published in England by Routledge and Kegan Paul, and in America by Little Brown, Boston.
Yes.
Oh, yes, I knew him very well. It so happened that when he came to the Abbey Theatre, and I was a young man, part-time actor, we became very great friends, inseparable. I was with him during the writing of all his principal plays, the main plays, until he went to London. And I wasn't with him, of course, during the later period. And the tragedy was that we quarreled. We quarreled because he set great store on my opinion, and I did not think that his later plays were as good as his first masterpieces, Juno and the Peacock, The Blow and the Stars, and The Shadow of a Gunman. So it's a rather sad book from that point of view, because it describes our little quarrel.
The way you live together. And,
yeah.
What about Brendan Behan? I suppose everybody asks you, who has memories of Brendan Behan to share with us?
Well, my memories of Brendan, I didn't know him as intimately as other people knew him. Perhaps Mr. Kelly knew him even better than I did. But the little I knew of him, somebody when he died said he had a heart as big as the Isle of Man. And there's a great deal of truth in that. He was in the Republican movement, just as our manager was in the Republican movement.
Tell us about that.
I remember meeting Brendan, I think it was first about 1928. I was 27. It was at the funeral of Countess Margaret. I think that was 28. At that time, Brendan was 2 years younger than me. I was about six or so, and he was about four. And I always remember him. He was what we call a Fianna Boy Scout, you know. And I always remember he had white canvas shoes. But but from his early days, you know, he was always a writer, you know. But as you know, his language could be quite choice at times.
Yes.
And before coming here, I was manager of the Gaiety Theatre, which is at the Opera House of Dublin, you know, and quite a nice place. But Brendan and I always spoke in Irish. It doesn't sound half as bad in the Irish language, you know. But you know, this year, as Mr. Fallon was telling you, Borstleboy is going to the Alban Theatre on Broadway.
Great.
It'll be there for St. Patrick's Day. And very funny, at that time, well, just slightly later, we are mounting a production of The Hostage. This is the first time it's been done in the Abbey Theatre, The Hostage.
Oh.
And we're bringing it to the Vienna Festival, and we're bringing it to Frankfurt, Antwerp, Zurich, and Geneva. Last year, for 4 months of the year, we had The Queer Fellow. So the Abbey, at last, is showing its what it owes to Brendan Behan, you know?
We've seen The Hostage several times now.
Yes, yes, we have. And we've seen Queer Fellow.
Yeah.
Not seen The Worst of Boy, of course. I'm curious about how do you work things now? Like, for instance, Hadrian the Seventh is playing here right now. How long will it run, or how long has it been running? Do you run one show at a time, and what's the system?
Well, as you know, we are a repertory theatre, and therefore we normally don't plan so long ahead. We run a play, and we have another play in rehearsal. And so there's other reasons to be taken, not so much box office. It might be the reason whether the next play is ready. It might be the timing for a certain play. It might be that we want to bring it on tour. For Adrian, we did plan a 7-week run for it. But the reason for that was to give us time to get our next production, which is The Moon and the Yellow River, ready. I think the one great thing about the Abbey Theatre compared to other theatres in Ireland, and probably to all commercial theatres, is the amount of time you can devote to rehearsals. I mean, when Long Day's Journey was done here, we devoted 5 months to the rehearsals for that. Mm-hmm. In a commercial theatre, you're trying to make do with 3 weeks, mm-hmm. you know, and if the manager is very generous, you might get four, and really you cannot put on a play.
You can't even master the lines.
No. But the normal plan here is for new plays to be mounted in the spring and in the autumn, and in summer then to do just a repertoire. We try in parts of the summer so the visitors can see two plays to put on, to change our bill halfway through the week. And that's not for the want of audience, because in the summer we are doing capacity business, but rather to give them a choice when they do come. We are very lucky with our attendances here. It will be up to about 90% in the year.
That is fantastic. That was my next thought, of the percentage of outsiders who come to the theater, but they don't sustain it, especially during the wintertime.
No. But because we haven't got the valley, which most theaters have in their summer months, and in fact some theaters close down in the summer months, quite a few theaters, as you know, and close down in the summer, but we in fact do 101% during the summer months, you know. So that brings up, we haven't got that valley which to bring down our average, but we are, thanks to God, we're very successful in the winter months too. We have been so far at any rate. And so now I'd say we average about 90% in the year.
Well, the influence that the Abbey Theater has had on theaters all over the world, on young actors, on colleges, the university level, the professional level, the playwrights, it's just an amazing thing that has come out of the, well, I choose to call it the beauty of the soul of the Irish. Whether he is writing, whether he is singing, whether he is acting, there is a very particular quality in the Irish. Are you so close to it you're unaware of it?
Well, yes, we are so close to it that we're not aware of it. We're aware of it when people like yourself come and tell us of it, and many do, particularly during the summer months, because Mr. Kelly here had a rather bright idea a few years ago that people like myself should meet visitors at the Abbey Theatre during the summer months at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and bring them on a tour of the Abbey and tell them the history of the place. And it's really amazing the cross-section of visitors we get, mostly, of course, from the United States and from colleges, sometimes students, sometimes professors. And it works both ways. They are amazed by what they hear, and I am amazed at their reaction to what they hear. Mm-hmm. But there's no doubt about it that the Abbey Theatre's fame in America, Australia, all over the world, is far, far greater than it is at home. Mm-hmm. But it occurred to me that you might like to know that the director of The Hostage is Professor Hugh Hunt, who's Professor of Drama at the University of Manchester. Now, you might say that's an extraordinary thing to have a man from Manchester come and direct your plays. Well, now, way back in the 30s, the early 30s, the poet John Masefield, who was a great friend of William Butler Yeats, wrote to Yeats and said that there was a young man who was very interested in the theatre, a young man whose name was Hugh Hunt, and might he come and serve an apprenticeship at the Abbey. So this young man, Hugh Hunt, came over and served quite a long apprenticeship. It was about 10 or 12 years. Went back to Manchester, became professor of drama at the university, got a commission concerning the Elizabethan Trust to go and establish theatre in Australia. Now, young Mr. Hunt went out and did that and gave Australia its first repertory theatre, which, as he said, was based on the lines of the world-famous Abbey Theatre in Dublin. Now, he is at the moment our artistic director and will be for the next 2 years. Of course, he knows the Abbey well, having served his apprenticeship here. And at the same time, it's interesting to know that his brother is Lord Hunt of Everest fame.
Oh, yes, that. Well, for heaven's sake, now you hit me in a...
Sea fame.
Oh, you hit me in a sensitive spot there. Isn't that interesting? Well, now that's exactly what I was speaking of, though, how the Hunt influence from the Abbey has now gone to Australia, all around the world.
Yes.
Mr. Kelly, let's just, for the fun of it, reach back in your mind, in your experience, and you pull something, some story, something that is a fond memory. The first thing that hits your mind has to do with a theater or with a person here or your relationship to the theater. I'm just probing around now for something that just... comes out of you.
Well, I remember another character in Irish history, in Irish theatre history, was Jimmy O'Dea, who was our leading comedian. And I remember as a young chap going in as manager of the Gaiety Theatre and full of bright ideas, you see. So I decided to run theatre trains from all over Ireland. And we had just finished a season with Jimmy O'Dea, and Jimmy was out on tour. So Jimmy went into a small place down in County Kerry, which is about 190 miles from Dublin, to start his week in Killorgan, to find everybody who were going to the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin, because I had organized a special train for it. So O'Dea sent me a telegram which said, "Kelly, stop fecking my audience." Fecking is a derogatory word in Ireland for stealing.
That's a pretty dirty trick, too.
Jimmy O'Dea, who was undoubtedly Ireland's greatest comedian, the pity of it was that he didn't want to tour, he didn't want to travel. He did go at he did go to Hollywood, and he did play in a film there for
Walt Disney.
Jimmy didn't want to live there. It was a great pity because had Jimmy toured as the Abbey Theatre toured, he would have been just as famous as an Irish comedian. But the point I'd like to make out is this, that Jimmy was a very fine little serious actor before he became a comedian, and played in the Abbey many times. Played with the Dublin Drama League. Now, the Dublin Drama League was an organization founded by Yeats and by Lennox Robinson, who was managing director of the theatre once upon a time and one of our famous playwrights. And they founded this organization in order that Dublin might see continental masterpieces. And therefore, all the great plays of, say, the European 20s and 30s were done here in the Abbey Theatre by Abbey actors. And during that period, Jimmy O'Dea was one of the finest serious actors we had here. And then suddenly he decided to become a comedian. And undoubtedly he was the greatest comedian that Ireland ever produced. And the pity of it is that the world never got to know him. Because for some reason or another, he just could not take to Hollywood. And they made him fabulous offers to stay there. No, he wouldn't. He wanted to come back here to Dublin. And in a sense, you know, being behaved in the same way, Dublin was in his bones, just as Dublin was in Jimmy O'Dea's bones, just as Dublin is in the bones of every Dubliner, and I speak to third generation Dubliner.
I can see that. I can see it. The great feeling of the people for the city and
yes.
its tradition.
Like, take the case of James Joyce. Now, I mention that for this reason, that Dublin was O.K.C. and O.K.C. was Dublin. But the distinction between O.K.C. and Joyce was this. When Joyce went away, he took Dublin with him. And indeed, when he was living in Paris, he heard of somebody who was from Dublin, he sent for him immediately. But O'Casey did not do that. O'Casey could never integrate with the English district or people amongst whom he lived. He just couldn't do it. And the tragedy was he never came back here. Because all his material was here, and it's still here. And if you're travelling on, say, a Dublin bus or walking a Dublin street, you keep your ears open, you will hear O'Casey's dialogue, just as it's in its place.
Beautiful trip to Ireland, to the Abbey Theatre, to hear our friends speak of this theatre with the high degree of respect that we had hoped and we knew would be in this particular building. Mr. Fallon, before we leave, we can't tie you up all day. I would like to reach into your mind, as we did to Mr. Kelly a moment ago, and either have an impression, a memory, or something that sort of comes out into sharp focus of your years of experience with this organization.
Well, on the 21st birthday of the Abbey Theatre, I stood on the stage of the original building, and I listened to a speech made by Lady Gregory. I think I told you when we passed her portrait that she was a person to whom we really owe the Abbey Theatre, because she was a woman of indomitable will. And she made a speech on that occasion, which taught me a great lesson, because she said that the essential purpose or function of theatre was the cooperation of the three A's, actor, author, and audience. And she said as long as these three held together, that the Abbey Theatre would go into the far future. And she was perfectly right in saying that. And she quoted from a play by Yeats, and she said, "So that the long-remembering harpers may have matter for their song." And that is my greatest memory of the Abbey Theatre.
Mr. Fallon, Mr. Kelly.